Alright, welcome to 2,000 Years of Jewish Odyssey, Part 14, sponsored again by Becky Navikatz, Le'ila Nishmas, Yonah ben Rab Aryeh Leib. Tonight we're discussing the 14th century. So the Rindfleisch massacres in the late 1290s had a far-reaching effect on Jewish life. Thousands of Jews were murdered in cold blood, entire communities were destroyed, and again the Shum cities of the Rhine, Shapira, Vermaisa, Magenza, and dozens of other communities were also wiped out, including Nuremberg, where, as I mentioned last time, the Mordechai, one of the great Rishonim and commentators on the Talmud, was killed along with his entire family. To tell you that I was in Nuremberg about 4 years ago, and I remember standing in the Marketplatz, which is in the central square of Nuremberg, overhearing a guide, I was there myself at the time, overhearing a guide say in English in front of what they call the beautiful fountain. That's a very hideous display, but in front of the beautiful fountain, saying, this is where the Jewish community was in that period of time. It was a very undesirable area, and at one end of the Marketplatz is an enormous church called the Frau Kirche, Our Lady's Church. And she said, that's where the shul, the main shul of Nuremberg, stood. And the Frau Kirche, the church, was built on the ruins of that shul in the 1300s. And when the community was destroyed, they literally burnt the shul down. And on the place of the shul, that's where they built what's now one of the largest churches in Nuremberg, still extant today. Now, that destruction and construction was duplicated throughout Germany. In the Rindfleisch massacres, perhaps 100,000 Jews were killed in those rampages, Hashem Yikom Damam. And another further development, Jews now, as a result of these massacres in Germany, headed eastward in very large numbers to Poland, to Russia. By 1304, Krakow, for example, already had a Jewish community. And a few decades earlier, Duke Boleslav in Kalish issued a very progressive set of statutes that protected Jews, both physically and economically, from harm from Christians. If a Christian, for example, sued a Jew for monetary damages, it wasn't sufficient to bring just Christian witnesses, because he presumed they'd be biased. They had to bring at least one Jewish witness. If a Christian killed a Jew, he was in prison for it. If a Christian hurt a Jew, the Jew could sue him for damages. So for the time, it was very progressive. And the community then moved eastward. Although many Jews stayed in Germany anyway, only to be swept away in the decisive event of the 14th century, to which we'll return in a few moments. Some Jews headed to Spain, which although well into the Christian Reconquista, the reconquest of Spain, was still relatively hospitable and would be until the latter part of this century, when relations would collapse in a wave of terrifying violence and persecution. One great Jew who moved to Spain was one of the leading disciples of the Maharami Rutenberg, and that's Rabbeinu Osher ben Yechiel, better known to us as the Rosh. The Rosh lived from 1350 to 1327, and he became the leader of German Jewry after the Maharam was imprisoned. In fact, the Rosh was the one who tried to ransom the Maharam from prison, and the Maharam refused to be ransomed. After the massacre, the Rosh called a convocation of rabbis to deal with a unique issue, the distribution of property of those who were murdered without heirs, meaning as a result of the Rindfleisch massacres, like in the Holocaust, sometimes whole families were eliminated. What happens to the property that family owned? That's what the Rosh dealt with in the 1290s. As his fame spread, the Rosh feared that he would share the fate of the Maharam, and so he fled Germany westward. The Rosh was independently wealthy, he was a moneylender by profession, so he was able to travel through Provence, where he spent some time, and then on to Spain, where he arrived in 1306, immediately becoming the Avbeis in Toledo, where he was recommended by the Rashba. They'd only known each other through correspondence, and there the Rosh spent the rest of his life. Now, if you can imagine, it's not that hard to imagine, it was not a natural match. This German Jew, the last of the German Balei Tosfos, right in the heart of Spanish Jewry in Toledo. It was a culture clash on both ends. In one Shuva, the Rosh writes that he was shocked to find out that Bate Din in Spain had powers of execution, which they used when they saw fit over his objections, but they used it. Meaning the Bate Din, the Jewish courts in Spain at the time were autonomous, and they could put people to death, Jews to death, no, of course, not Christians, Jews to death for a variety of crimes, and the government did not interfere. The theory was the king never minded when Jews killed their own. It saved him the work. Now, the Rosh was also strongly against the study of philosophy and even against the study of secular knowledge generally. So he didn't really relate that well to Spanish Jews, of whom even the religious had a very broad knowledge of the world, literature, philosophy, the arts. They were cultured, certainly by Central and Eastern European standards, and the Rosh could never accept that. So he was the outbasin, but he never really became part of the society. The Rosh compiled his own Tosfos, known as the Tosfos HaRosh, on several Mesechtos, but he's most famous for his commentary on the Gemara, which is in the back of every Gemara, essentially a summary of the Gemara's discussion, followed by the views of the Gaonim and the Rishonim up to his time, and then the Rosh's Psak, or what he said was the common custom of his time. Some things we learn through the Rosh, other things we see that the Rosh did differently. Just off the top of my head, there's a famous Rosh where he speaks about the recitation of the Hasienu on Rosh Hashanah, because it's the day of Simcha. Of course, we don't say the Hasienu Rosh Hashanah, we only say Tfilos related to forgiveness. The Rosh also clarified for us, for example, how they blew shofar in Europe, which is similar to how we blow it today as well. The Rosh brought the German methodology of learning to Spain, which did not exist before, and he was very careful to maintain his own minhagim, the German minhagim, which he felt were more authoritative than those of the Sfardim. The Rosh also wrote the very beautiful little work of Musar that's studied until today called Orchos Chaim, The Ways of Life. It's only 12 pages, divided into the days of the week, with several dozen very pithy recommendations for each day. So each person is a type of little sefer that a person can carry with him and look at every single day, dealing with every aspect of life. For example, the very first point he makes on Sunday, Yom Rishon, a person should keep far from haughtiness. And then he says, keep far from flattery and from falsehoods and frivolity. Later, another day of the week, he recommends always be among the first 10 people to shul. The first 10, which became, of course, a custom that, the Gemara mentions it, but we know it's already in our liturgy. Never converse idly in shul. Apparently there's an issue then as well. Don't rely on handouts, neither from the government or anyone else, but work for your own food. That was the advice of the Rosh. And very interestingly, he said every night before going to sleep, forgive verbally every person who wronged you during the day. It'll just clear your head and let you sleep a little more peacefully. And he said, never disparage and always honor your wife. And again, you have perhaps a few hundred of these little aphorisms that a person can look at every single day. The Rosh had 8 sons, most famous to us, Rabbi Yaakov Balaturim. The Balaturim is son Yaakov, 1275 to 1340. The Balaturim fled with his father to Spain and ever thereafter loathed Germany. He wrote in 1329, it is forbidden for a person even to traverse there, meaning you can't even pass through Germany, much less to live in such a land of blood. That's how he looked at it in the 14th century. His younger brother, Rav Yehuda, succeeded his father, the Rosh, as the Rav of Toledo, which allowed Rabbi Yaakov to serve on the Beis Din and therefore had more time to write. Practicing rabbis don't really have that much time to write. So the Balaturim was able to write 2 very memorable works. First, the Arba Turim. The Arba Turim the four pillars, the four columns, 200 years later, became the basis for the Shulchan Aruch. So it's the Baal HaTurim who divided Halacha, the entire corpus of Halacha, into four different pillars arose the Turim. Orachayim, Yoredeya, Ebenezer, Choshen Mishpat. Orachayim dealing with days of daily life, and Shabbos, Yom Tov. Yoredeya dealing with personal issues like Kashrus and Nida and Tzedakah, Avelus. Ebenezer dealing with marital issues, marriage and divorce, and Choshen Mishpat dealing with civil law. He was the one who made those decisions. So he wrote the Sefer. He divided that into chapters. The way of a Rosh is almost like a run-on sentence. He would cite the Gemara, the various opinions of Rishonim, both Ashkenazim and Sardim, often concluding with his father's opinion, saying, you see these hundreds of times, Aleph Aleph, V'Adoni Ovi HaRosh Zal said, my father, my master, the Rosh of blessed memory, said as follows. Now there are numerous commentaries written on the tour, most famous, that, well, if you look at the tour, you have the Bach on one side, the Drishon HaPrisha, you have the Beis Yosef of Rav Yosef Karo. Rav Yosef Karo, about 200 years later, a little less, wrote a commentary on the tour. The Darkei Moshe of the Ramah became another commentary on the tour. And both the Beis Yosef and the Darkei Moshe were synopsized into what became the Shulchan Aruch and the Mapa and the Shulchan Aruch of the Ramah. But everything started with a tour, and it's very hard to imagine, in fact it's impossible to imagine, that there ever would have been a Shulchan Aruch had there not been a tour first. And the tour is therefore the fundamental work through which we begin a study of what the Halacha is. Remember, the Rambam is systematic, but the Rambam didn't quote any sources. And the Rambam doesn't really have any chapter headings. You have to go parak to parak to find what you want. Here we study Halacha through the Torah. It's very common. And what made it unique was its accessibility. In Simonim, with each Simon having a chapter heading. So you know what the topic is. You know how to find Hilchos Pesach and the specifics of Hilchos Pesach or whatever it is. So therefore became a very, very accessible, in fact, indispensable work. That was the tour of Rabbi Yaakov, the son of the Rosh. He also wrote another commentary on the Torah called the Baal HaTurim as well, that you have to have a particular knack for. It's filled with gematrios and very succinct insights without any elaboration. Sometimes two, three words, other times a sentence or less. So just to give you a flavor of the Baal HaTurim, on last week's Sedra and this week's, there's a pasuk Vayivin Mizbech Lefanov that he built. Aaron built a Mizbech in front of them by the Chet HaEgel. So he writes that in Gematria, Vayivin Mizbech Lefanov in Gematria equals Zehu Chur. Chur, of course, was killed. That's the allusion to Chur being killed. The Mizbeach, the Zevach, was Chur. If you do the calculations, of course, Vayivim is Bechlef Manov is 233, and Zeu Chur is 232. But it's close enough. So therefore, if you're within one, the rule of Gematria is you're satisfied. Or he said that Moshe saw that people keep Virahu. They were in an evil way. Beis, Resh, Ayin. Virahu. If you switch around the letters, Virahu, Virah spells Erev. See, he says, Berahu, that's the Erev Rav. And the Erev Rav was fomenting trouble. Well, to bring it to this week, really bridge the 2 weeks of Kisis and Vayakel, he asks at the beginning of this week, Sedra, why was the Parsha of Shabbos, with which the Torah begins this week, Sheshes Yamim Tavod, why was that juxtaposed to the portion at the end of Kisisa that dealt with Kikaran or Pnei Moshe? Moshe's face became radiant. What's the connection between the two? Between Shabbos and the radiance of Moshe's face? So the Torah says, we all know, a Jew has a different radiance on Shabbos. A Jew's face is different on Shabbos. So the face that Moshe has, that glow, that's the glow that Jews have every Shabbos. That's the pithy insight of the Torah. Now, there was another disciple of the Rosh, Rav Ashtori HaParthi, 1280-1345, he fled Provence, and in the early part of the 1300s, he became one of the few Rabbonim, the few people really, to make Aliyah. He dwelled in Beit Shan the rest of his life. Ashtori HaParthi, He wrote a very famous sefer called Kaftor Boferat that's quoted very often today about the laws of Eretz Yisrael, especially the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael, which has been a very modern issue the last 40 years, that many of the opinions today are based on the conclusions of the Kaftor Boferat of Rav Eshtori Haparchi. In Spain as well, in the 14th century, there are many other important works and gedolim that were written and disseminated. The gedolim who taught Torah, we mentioned last week just briefly, the Ritva, Rabbi Yom Tov ben Avram Asavili, the Ritva of Seville. He was a disciple of the Rashba, author of another famous commentary on the Talmud. Rabbeinu Bachya ben Asher wrote a commentary on the Torah. Each part is introduced by a pasuk from Mishlei that elicits some ethical principle. Then he continues with his commentary. You have the Ran, Rabbeinu Nisim, who's the Rav of Barcelona, 1290 to 1375. One of the great commentators on the Rif, that's the Ran in the back of the Gemara. Although people say today, with some accuracy, some of the Masechtos attributed to him were written by others. Some attributed to others were written really by him. On the Sefes Nedarim, for example, he's not in the back of the Gemara, but he takes Rashi's place on the side of the Gemara. The Ran also wrote the famous Droshos Haran, the lectures, or the sermons, good word, the sermon, amazing I forget that, the sermons of the Ran, 12 essays in all, about the Yesodei Hadas, based on different incidents in the Torah. And the Ran is very beautiful, still studied today as well, because very profound. More or less it's easy reading, although the ideas are complicated, but it's a beautiful explication of the fundamentals of our faith. Yet another Gadol, almost unknown by name, one of those classic cases where someone is known by his sefer and not his name, Rav Vidal, Vidal meaning life, Vidal of Tolosa. What did he write? Anyone? He's the author of the Magid Mishnah on the Rambams. He's known as the Rav HaMagid, Rav Vidal of Tolosa. The Magid Mishnah was basically a defense of the Rambam against the criticisms of the Ravid, another sefer at the same time, written by another person, Shem Tov, called the Migdal Oz, similar construct. Also, in the 14th century in Spain, had Rav David Abudraham, wrote one of the first commentaries on Tefillah, as well as the laws and customs of the Tefillah, which is not only expand and study, but is a basic resource today as well. And Rabbi Yitzchak Abohav, the author of the great ethical work, Minaras HaMa'or, is reprinted just a few years ago, but again, the famous Musa work. So all in all, it's a very fertile and productive century for Spanish Jews. There are others too, we'll get back to it later, but all of this would come crashing down on their heads. First, though, Ashkenazic Jewry would live through one of the nadirs of European Jewish life. Christian Europe had already perfected in the 12th century and 13th century accusations against Jews of ritual murder and blood libels, desecrations of the host, all in order to have pretexts for assaults on Jews. Other times Jews were attacked for religious reasons or economic reasons. It was the Shepherd's Crusade, the second Shepherd's Crusade, if you're scoring at home, in 1320, that destroyed 120 Jewish communities in France, inspired by a shepherd who had a vision of the Holy Spirit that told him to go to Spain and fight the Moors and to kill Jews en route. So he had 120 communities destroyed during the Shepherd's Crusade. To all that was added a new and horrific accusation because of one of the most devastating plagues ever to afflict mankind, and that was the Black Death that began in 1347. Today we know it as the bubonic plague. The Black Death entered Europe from the Mediterranean area. We don't really know where, maybe Genoa, maybe Sicily, Sardinia. It was born, the plague was, by fleas on rats that traveled on the cargo ships of the Mediterranean, possibly brought from Asia. No one really knows for sure, ad hayom, until today, what the source was. But the virus, it's not a very attractive proposition having rats on ships, much less having fleas on those rats. But the virus was first spread by the fleas and along the port cities of Italy and southern France, and then it went continental and stretched the entire continent and really devastated the world. It infected, in fact, the very air, making breathing hazardous and death rampant. Black Death was one of the worst pandemics in history, killing about 75 million people across the world. Some estimate as many as 200 million people were killed. It reduced Europe's population by from a third to a half. The infection, the plague, attacked the lungs and the circulatory system. Boils grew on people, and the infected had a life expectancy of less than 1 week. And the Jews were blamed, with the prevalent accusation that Jews had poisoned the wells and infected all of Europe. This was buttressed by a report in 1348 that Jews in Geneva had confessed, under duress, to giving what was called a package of poison to one John of Savoy for him to distribute in the wells, springs, and cisterns across Europe wherever he went. Now, very interestingly, in 1348, Pope Clement VI issued a papal bull exonerating the Jews. It was before the worst of the massacres began, and a variety of kings, including the Holy Roman Emperor, the King of Aragon, also issued statements absolving the Jews from any guilt, all to no avail. What happened, just as an aside, the Pope's authority had waned in the 14th century, mostly because of the great schism in Christianity in the 14th century, a power play between the Pope and the Holy Roman Emperor. In the early part of the century, Pope Boniface VIII was deposed by Philip the Fair of France. Clement V became the Pope, and he moved the seat of the papacy from Rome to Avignon in Provence in southern Spain, where in fact the papacy resided until 1377. So for most of the century, the Pope did not live in Rome, but lived in southern France. There, the papacy was, how shall we say, corrupted. Bishops' offices were bought and sold. The popes all lived in luxury, and they became more and more distant from their own people. One consequence of this was that when the papacy returned to Rome, Avignon retained its own pope, so for some time there were rival popes. At one point, there were even three popes serving simultaneously, which is a lot of popes at one time. Add to this mix the Hundred Years' War. You know, we complain about the Iraq. Hundred Years' War wasn't even 100 years, 1337 to 1453. It was 116 years. They just rounded down, I guess, for simplicity's sake. The Hundred Years' War between rival French factions and between France and England and France and other countries. So Europe was in turmoil. The immediate loss of all of this was respect for the popes and the kings. So when the pope or the kings defended the Jews against these charges, they could be easily ignored, and so they were. Even more fascinating, Clement VI rejected claims that were told to him by some of his advisors that the plague was caused by the stars, by a bad alignment of planets and stars. Clement VI was university educated, a doctorate from University of Paris, and so he did what by modern standards is very rational, but at the time was very innovative. He demanded autopsies of the victims, of whom there were about 11,000 had died just in Avignon, including seven cardinals. So he demanded autopsies to examine the bodies and try to find the source of the disease, what the disease was and where it was coming from, which again was very sophisticated for the time. We're talking the middle of the 14th century. But he did protect the Jews in Avignon. He could not protect the Jews most elsewhere. The enemy alleged that Jews were not dying of the plague, even though Clement VI said, you see, Jews in Avignon also died. Well, they said they were dying in lesser numbers, and the fact is that part of it was at least partially true. Jews did die by the thousands, But in fact, Jews were less subject to the excesses of the plague by virtue of the norms of Jewish life, which were totally at odds with the norms of non-Jewish life. Think about it. A Jew gets up in the morning, we have to wash our hands. We wash our hands before davening. We wash our hands before eating bread. We wash our hands when we leave the bathroom. We bury the dead immediately. And much of the plague was transmitted by the presence of dead bodies that even today Christians keep around for days. A little more hygienic today, but nonetheless, we bury immediately, even the same day in those times. They didn't, and they added to the plague. Europe's streets at the time were also lined on either side with open sewers that not only reeked as the refuse sat there, but also spread disease. But in fact, Jewish communities were different. We can't say brachos. We can't daven in proximity to an open sewer. So our waste disposal was much more sanitary. Nevertheless, we were accused of conspiring with the devil to kill Christians and of poisoning the wells, even though Jews drank from the same wells, so we were charged them with whispering incantations, namely a bracha, before drinking from that well that nullified the effects of the poison. Well, for 4 years across Europe, Jews, especially in Germany and Austria and thereabouts, were brutally victimized in incessant pogroms. Tens of thousands of Jews were killed, Rachman al-Islam. Hundreds of Jewish communities were destroyed completely. It was 1096, the First Crusade, all over again. In many places, Worms, for example, Oppenheim, Jews committed mass suicide rather than have their children taken away. And as before, baptism, which was the only escape route, had no takers. The fact is that more Jews die from the massacre than from the plagues. And the massacres continued even after 1350, when even the Christians realized that Jews were not to blame, because millions of people had died in Asia, where there were no Jews at all, and in fact no Christians either. But nonetheless, the rampages continued through 1352. After the plague, there were very few Jews remaining in Germany or the Low Countries, but it's a small world. Then the world was even smaller. So Jews, in fact, were forced to rebuild, to pick up the pieces of battered lives and shattered communities. When they came back, Jews, for example, were in many places, were simultaneously cursed and welcomed back for economic reasons. For example, 1361, when the Jews had been expelled from France in the beginning of the century, in 1361, Jews were brought back to France by Charles V, only to be sent packing again a few years later, and again for good, so to speak, in 1394. In Germany, Jews also returned and also started the business again, which Christians needed. So in 1385, the emperor forgave the debts that 38 towns owed Jews. So imagine what that did to the finance business. The debts of 38 entire towns, the citizenry of 38 towns, no longer had to pay back their Jewish moneylenders. The Black Death had two lasting consequences, unforeseen before, that shaped Jewish life until today. One was through the auspices of Rav Meir ben Baruch Halevi, who was born in Fulda, Germany, lived 1320 to 1390. He became the Rav of Vienna after 1360, and probably the leader of Central Europe after the Black Death, a great Talmid Chacham. He spearheaded the rebuilding of Jewish communities across Central Europe when in fact there were no Jews or skeleton communities. Well, how do you provide for the spiritual needs of skeleton communities across Europe? Remember, Baruch Halevi noticed that charlatans and incompetents were stepping into the spiritual breach, proclaiming themselves rabbis, and so he decreed that henceforth only individuals who were properly ordained can serve as rabbis, and he formalized the process by which ordination could be obtained. He even gave the title, Morenu, that German Jews would use for musmachim until modern times. But the notion of a commonly accepted smicha as a prerequisite for service as a rabbi was a consequence of the chaos in the wake of the Black Death persecutions. Before, a person was judged on his merits. You came in, you give a shiur, you knew what you're talking about, they liked you. You taught in yeshiva, you became the rabbi of the town, served in the basement. It was done completely on merit. Rav Meir ben Bar Halevi of Vienna really objectified the system. So there'd be people who would be able to certify that so-and-so is a proper rav, and this way the proper or properly ordained rabbanim could be dispatched to a variety of communities with the haskama of the rav of Vienna. And there was another development. This development led to this other one. Historically, rabbis were never paid. Even community rabbis, even Rosh Yeshiva. So it wasn't just the sages of the Talmud, but also the Rishonim. They all worked. Merchants, farmers, vintners, doctors, moneylenders, craftsmen, smiths. They all worked in some form. That's how they supported themselves. That also changed now in the wake of the Black Death, beginning in Austria and then spreading across the Jewish world. I wouldn't say spreading like wildfire, but it spread across the Jewish world, although not yet to the Eidot HaMizrach. Community rabbis were to be paid by their communities. So in fact, they became literally public servants. And obviously, while the advantages are clear, there are disadvantages that are equally clear. Loss of autonomy, loss of independence, fear of losing the position if you say the wrong thing, competition for positions because larger communities paid more money, etc. This is, of course, against the psak of the Rambam, as one of the Gedolim of the time wrote. What can we do? The Nesher HaGadol has spoken, the great eagle has said his piece, but now the times are different, and in fact, that's the way it has been ever since that Rabbanim are paid. Now, there are several other noteworthy Gedolim of the time in this location. One was Rav Shalom of Wiener Neustadt, which is just south of Vienna, known as Sar Shalom. He was the Rebbe of his more famous Talmud, the Maharil, the great Ashkenazic Posek, that we'll encounter more in the 15th century. Another Gadol was Rav Yom Tov Lipman of Milhuizen, who is the Dayan of Prague. A very interesting story about him. He anonymously wrote a book called the Sefer HaNitzachon, the Book of Victory, which was essentially a book of refutations of Christian dogma that Jews could use in disputations. As can be imagined, this did not sit well with the Christian authorities, and they tried for years to trace the book to its author. Rav Yom Tov Lipman of Milhuizen was eventually informed on in 1399 by an apostate Jew named Peter. He was thrown into prison with dozens of other Jews. There he defended himself against charges of insulting Christianity, but he escaped death, one of the few. 80 Jews were martyred there, Al Kiddush Hashem, in 1399, as a result of this instigation, the accusation that Jews had insulted Christianity. But all that pales before the catastrophe that befell Spanish Jewry at the end of the century and heralded the end of their productive existence, really their indispensable contributions to Jewish life. I'm referring, of course, to the massacres of 1391. The year 1391 is tragic and frightful for Spanish Jews, perhaps even more so than 1492. In a real sense, what happened in 1391 was more of a turning point in Spanish Jewish history than even the expulsion in 1492. After 1391, what happened in 1492 was almost to be expected. Well, in the preceding decades, pressure had grown and grown on Jews, Christian pressure. The country became more and more fervent religiously, and the effects of the Inquisition were pervasive in all aspects of life. Remember again, the Inquisition was basically an investigation and prosecution of deviant Christians, really heretical Catholics, including conversos, Jews have converted, but never practicing Jews. But one of the tools that the Inquisition used, which made it so infamous, besides the torture, practices that were later adopted by the NKVD in Stalin's time, was the notion of informing on fellow citizens. So if a particular Christian was accused of a heresy, or not saying his prayers, or confessing, or whatever it was, one of the ways he could get in the good graces of the inquisitors was to rat out fellow citizens. He could also avoid fines that way. So that led itself to false accusations and convictions. But it roiled the population into a frenzy, and then it became a Jewish problem. Already in the 1380s, there was a rabid Jew-hating priest, actually an archbishop, named Ferran Martinez, who traveled throughout Spain openly fomenting attacks on Jews. He preached for a while, spaced the same tune, but the Jews were always able to ward off his threats with pleas to royal officials who protected Jews. In fact, it was a case in the 1380s where they even sued him before the magistrate, Alcalde, the mayor of Seville, and he was tried for his attacks on Jews. He was unrepentant. He continued his preaching. It must get pretty dull to hear the same drush every week, but eventually it caught on. His basic theme was that he blamed Jews for obstructing Christian prosperity. Jews in Spain were more or less well off, Christians less so, and therefore he said prosperity is the natural right of the followers of Jesus, and the Jews have usurped our wealth. Well, the Jews were protected by the establishment, but his efforts finally bore fruit on June 4, 1391. There's always a confluence of unrelated events that lead to these tragedies here too. Both the King of Spain and the Archbishop in southern Spain died in 1390. So there was a leadership gap that Martinez exploited. On June 4, 1391, riots broke out in Seville, and then quickly spread throughout the country. In just 2 months, more than 50,000 Jews were killed, brutally murdered. Other Jews fled. But for the first time in Jewish history, the predominant response to this persecution, to the choice of convert or die, was in fact conversion, for the very first time. In the ensuing two decades, after the riots of 1391, perhaps 200,000 Jews, a third to a half of Spanish Jews, of all Jews living in Iberia, converted to Christianity, and from all classes, the rich and the poor, the educated, the uneducated, the simple people, and even some Rabbanim. The Rav of Burgos, Rav Shlomo Halevi, he himself converted. He became the Bishop of Burgos. You can't really say it's a lateral move. But nonetheless, he went from being the Rav of Burgos to the Bishop of Burgos, and there he became a fierce Jew hater, as we'll see in the next century as well, taking on the name Pablo de Santa Maria. Now, all the conversions were under duress, but many Jews sincerely embraced Christianity, regardless of the pressure. Many others, of course, converted as a pretense, becoming what became known as conversos, in Hebrew, anusim, or moranos, that is swine in the pejorative Spanish. That's why it's a disgraceful term to use, moranos. It's what they call Jew, those resented having Jewish converts. We call them conversos, those who converted, or anusim, miloshen ones, those who were forced to convert. Now, the conversos continued to be persecuted by the Inquisition for any deviation. They were watched like hawks. Famously, as we know, they would light candles Friday night in secret. They would gather in secret to daven, to fast Yom Kippurim, etc. In Toledo, in 1391, there were 5 yeshivas and 10 shuls, and very little that survived the pogroms. And the conversos took root there. I was in Toledo a few years ago, the Goldsmiths as well. And I remember in one of the stores, a merchant took us to the basement of his store in the Juderia, in the Jewish section, the old Jewish section of Toledo, And he showed us a trap door that led to a secret passage, tunnels, that connected all the Jewish homes. All of the homes had a secret door that led to this passageway where the Jews would gather at night whenever they wanted to do Jewish things, daven, talk, etc. That was when I was late for the bus getting back. That's where I was. Because we haven't been to the store and he took us. Karen never forgives me for that. But in that story, you see the way they lived. It was all in secret. Many did not survive. They were exposed. They faced immediate death. In fact, they would go around with the pork and make sure that there was nothing burning in the house on Friday, that they wouldn't be having meat or any Shabbos meal. Candles would not be lit on Friday. That's what you find today across the world. There are thousands of people, for example, thousands, who observe some Jewish practice, like lighting candles in secret, without fully knowing why, except that they are descendants of conversos. So an article came out a couple months ago that said maybe 20, 25, 30% of everyone living in Iberia today is a descendant of conversos. And you find throughout Central and South America people with these strange practices. Remember, their mother, their grandmother went to a closet or a bedroom every Friday night to light candles, and they have no idea why. Now the world is more interconnected, and they realize more and more that they are descendants of conversos. I could tell you, in the year since I've been the head of the Beis Din LeGiur in Bergen County, I've had two descendants of conversos come to convert. Al pi halacha, to be practicing Jews. People trace their ancestry back centuries and remembered also in their youth that their mothers lit candles Friday night in secret, and it wasn't until they were older they found out what it meant, and they decided to find out more about Judaism and somehow made their way to Bergen County. Well, we could ask a question. What was the difference between Spanish Jewry and European Jewry? Central or Western European Jewry, why didn't the Jews of Germany or Austria convert? Why did Spanish Jews convert so easily? A number of reasons, I mean, no justifications obviously, a number of reasons. Spanish Jews generally enjoyed a very high standard of living, and they did not want to abandon that. So therefore, if the choice was to leave empty-handed or become Christians, they became Christians. Many, if not most, were not that learned in Torah. Many Eastern European Rabbanim, and even some Spanish Rabbanim, pointed to Spanish Jews' embrace of secular philosophy and culture as a critical factor, because they became very at home in the non-Jewish world. So again, to them, it wasn't that great a deviation. They weren't good Jews. They could be Shlechta Christians also. What's the difference, really? It wasn't worth dying over. And Jews by the thousands, tens of thousands, up to 200,000, felt the exact same way. And so they converted, for the most part, lost to Jewish history. There was another factor as well. Spanish Jews had experienced one of the first episodes of Mashiachei Sheker, false messiahs, in modern Jewish history. It was in the 13th century, a Jew named Avram Abulafia, who's a Kabbalist, traveled the world, and he began to preach the imminent arrival of the Mashiach, which always happens in stressful times, and in these centuries, it was always stressful. He became so convinced that Bias Mashiach was imminent that, get this, he traveled in 1280 to Rome with the intention of converting the Pope to Judaism. Well, that's a hard sell. The Pope heard about him, heard that he was coming, built a stake on which to burn him when he would arrive in Rome, but he was saved because the Pope had a stroke before Rav Avram Abulafia arrived. Nonetheless, he quickly returned to France and to Spain. In Spain, he was denounced by the Rashba and told to be quiet. Rav Avram Abulafia went to Greece to live and to write, and there he wrote, he predicted the coming of Mashiach in the 14th century. This news spread, as it always does, across the Jewish world. By 1391, Mashiach had not come. It left men, and worse, the Black Death and tens of thousands of Jews killed already. It left many Jews disillusioned, and disillusioned Jews are always ripe for conversion, and so it happened. But in fact, hundreds of thousands of Jews stayed and persevered, enduring unthinkable pressure for the next century that would culminate in the Great Expulsion of 1492. It was physical and financial pressure always applied to Jews, and spiritual pressure as well, constantly. Think of confiscation of property unless you convert, physical assault unless you convert, being subjected week after week to sermons and shul. Priests would come, the law was, the priest come and preach to the assembled in shul every Shabbos about Christianity and why they should convert. If you ask me, I said once, that's why Jews are averse to listening carefully to drushes on Shabbos. It's like built into our genes already, just to tune out what's being said. This came This came during the 14th century. They were forced to hear sermons from Christian preachers and just did not listen, train themselves not to listen. There'll be another disputation in the 15th century that would just leave the Jewish people reeling because of the unfairness of the whole process, but that also is for next time. Many Jews fled, especially to North Africa. Among the giants who left was the great Rivosh, Reb Yitzchak ben Sheshes, 1326 to 1407. He was a Talmud of the Ran. He was a Rav in Saragossa and other cities. He had a very strange and unfortunate life. The Rivosh, wherever he went, wherever the Rivosh went, he encountered strife in the community. And it was never his making, strange as it sounds. But the fact is, it was also emblematic of a community in decline. If you've ever noticed, people often fight more when there is little at stake than there's a lot at stake. And people fight more over petty things than they do over great things. Well, that was true already of Spanish Jews in the 14th century. So whatever city the Rivosh was in, for some reason, Machlokas always prevailed. The Rivosh was the author of voluminous Tshuvos, and he became, after the pogroms in 1391, the Rav in Algiers in northern Africa, again amid strife. He came to Algiers, he was appointed Rav by the community. Another rabbinical refugee from Spain wanted a position for himself. See, he kept Lahakis issuing Piska Halacha against those of the Rivosh. Think about it. If the Rivosh said something is Asur, and you had another guy come up and say, no, it's Mutter, who are the people going to listen to? So this was already in Algiers. The Rivosh was urged to put this Rav in Cheyrem, and he refused because he was a very humble spirit, until the other Rav convinced the local ruler, the governor of Algiers, not to let a boat of conversos dock in Algiers. They had enough refugees from Spain, didn't want any more. That the Rivosh could not accept. He put the man in Cheyrem. The community appealed to the governor to formally appoint the Rivosh the Rav of Algiers, and so he did, but that engendered the opposition of the Rashbats, another great Gaon, Reb Shimon ben Tzemach Duran, 1361 to 1444, who opposed, not unreasonably, getting the government involved in Jewish affairs, because that never turns out well for Jews. Nonetheless, that dispute was soon settled, and indeed the Rashbats, another prolific author of Tshuvos, succeeded the Rivosh as Rav of Algiers. As another great Jew I'll mention at the end of the century, Rav Chisdai Kreskas wrote one of the great works of Torah philosophy, the Or Hashem, basically anti-Aristotelian, a sense anti-Rambam as well, a defense of Torah. He stayed in Spain after the pogroms. His only son had been killed, unfortunately. Rav Chisdai Kreskas stayed, and he received permission to rebuild the communities of Barcelona and Valencia. Again, one of the ironies of Jewish life throughout the Middle Ages, that Jews were killed, and once the killing stopped, the non-Jews asked them to stay and to rebuild the community and to get back into business, because that benefited everyone. The Rav Chisdai Kreskas also reestablished yeshivos in Barcelona and Valencia. So in fact, Jews stayed in the many thousands, only to be there to live through the persecutions and expulsions of the 15th century. Well, a dark and tumultuous century ended on a brighter note despite the storm clouds brewing in Spain. You recall at the very beginning, I said that Jews had already started moving eastward. In fact, it had very positive connotations. In 1388, the Grand Duke Witold of Lithuania granted economic privileges to the Jews of Lithuania in Vilna, Grodno, Minsk, in the hopes that more Jews would immigrate to Lithuania. And in fact, more did, although they too would be expelled for a decade, beginning in 1495. Nonetheless, the focal point of Jewish life would thenceforth shift eastward in the 15th century to Italy and Turkey and to Eastern Europe. There was even a modest aliyah after the Black Death and after 1391. Muslim archives found not long ago on the Temple Mount record this Jewish aliyah of the late 14th century. But aliyah would increase dramatically in the next two centuries. In the meantime, the 14th century saw the greatness of the Rosh and his son, the Balaturim, the first comprehensive topical halachic work. The Spanish giants, the Ritva, the Ran, the David Abudraham, left a legacy of Torah scholarship that enriches us until today. We had permanent changes in the rabbinate, the formalization of smicha, and the notion of a paid rabbinate that I know vexes some until today. But tragically, the 14th century is remembered for the bloody massacres in the wake of the Black Death, and the pogroms in Spain that would generate the conversions of up to 200,000 Jews for the first time in our history, and herald the century that would see the end of Spanish Jewry after a productive existence of almost seven centuries. All that and more next time in the 15th century. I thank you all very much.